Hey, I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. If this is your first time hearing the show, great news. It's based on a really simple idea that we've all had educators in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether a teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of this show. You can tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations at teacherslounge@niu.edu. And truly, if you've never heard this show before, I think this is a great jumping on point because, you know, if you've been listening for a while, you might know that I'm a huge sucker for an end of the year best of list, whether it's best movies, best music, best episodes of your favorite education podcasts. So in that spirit, we are revisiting a few of our favorite Teachers Lounge conversations of 2024. It was a big year for us. This year, Teachers Lounge celebrated its fifth birthday. I know the pandemic has warped my perception of time quite a bit, but that one really threw me through a loop. We've been doing this show since August 2019, and in that time have featured well over 100 educators, all nominated by our audience. Again, it's been a great ride, and in 2024, we continue to bring more and more voices to the show. We talked with everyone from dance instructors to agriculture teachers, a music teacher exploring climate change with classical music, and a professor who wrote the first history of American motherhood. Over on our Teachers Lounge radio show, we followed a year in the life of a teacher every month, which ended in surprising fashion. And we also brought even more students into the fold through our student correspondence segment. Students on a speech team laughed and cried, reflecting on the end of their high school season, and elementary school kids acted out scenes from their drama class. And we could not do any of it without the support from you, and it's your nominations of educators in your life that power this show and have for the past 5 years. So if you want to nominate a teacher to be on the show in 2025, please send us an email to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And with all of that being said, let's dive in to a few of our favorite conversations of 2024. First up is a really fun one. You know, I always say that it feels like we've talked with every single kind of educator on the show, but this one was a new one for me. Jamie Vargo and Carl Linder are dance instructors at Vargo's Dance in Geneva, Illinois, and they invited me into their studio to chat with them about the very different paths that led them to dance, how to create a space that's both fun and comfortable for social dancing, often with strangers, their annual Michael Jackson Thriller street performance, and so much more.
Yeah, so I like to say we're not your average dance studio, in that we're 21 and older, first off, and then second, we focus more on social dancing than solo dancing or jazz, tap, ballet, things like that. So we also just teach partner dancing here. So anything you can do as a partnership, like salsa or swing dancing, hustle, most couples and singles are just kind of looking to get ready for like a social event or a wedding or, you know,
a lot of frantic people a couple weeks out from the wedding.
Lots of things like that. Or if you go to a bar and you hear some live music and you want to be able to grab somebody and just dance. So that's kind of what we're getting ready for.
Yeah.
Most of the time. We also have a liquor license, so that makes us a little bit different.
I'd say, because that's not typical for dance studios.
It's like, not typical, I don't think, at least not done the legal way like we have.
we
went through all the channels.
Yeah.
Try and keep it legal.
Yeah, I saw that on the website it talks about like social dance, and I thought that was just like an interesting phrase because like in a lot of ways, especially with the liquor license, like obviously, like nominally you guys teach dance, which is like the primary thing, but like you guys are also really in like the mood and vibe business because you're having to like cultivate this atmosphere that is both like fun and comfortable, but also where you do in fact learn something at the end of the day, right? It's not just like, oh, we're having a party where everyone is like, you know, five Manhattans deep.
You'd be amazed at how many people don't realize that, what you just said. That's huge,
Yeah, that's super huge. Agreed. A lot of people come because they're looking for friendship or community, and then they end up learning dance secondary. A lot of people come, their goal is to learn how to dance, and then they end up finding friendship and community. So it's really cool. It does kind of intertwine.
Is that something that you guys thought about, like, going into the business, being like, because I feel like with so much with teachers, right, like, when you start teaching, and I know that you were teaching before you had this business too, but, like, you get into it and you're like, I just have to know how to do the thing, right? Like, I just have to actually know how to communicate dance. But then you learn that the social and, like, the emotional part of it is just as important, if not more so, than the technical aspects of it.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think you were, when I was shocked when you said two subjects, one dance and the other one teaching, because they are not related.
Right.
They are very different subjects. They're both of them are arts within themselves.
Yeah.
I think that's accurate. I don't think a lot of people understand that either. Mm-hmm. All your interviewing must have gotten you talking to a lot of people about a lot of things. Plus, yes. You have an interesting family background, too.
Right. And, like, for both of you, obviously, like, you're both teachers, you're both dancers, and obviously the dancing probably came first for both of you. But, like, I'm sure there's plenty of people that are fantastic dancers that are not very good at communicating and teaching dance.
Right, I think that goes for any skill, right?
Yeah.
Just because you're an amazing skier doesn't mean you can teach skiing. Same thing for dance, we find that all the time. Dance is the only thing I've ever done, so I've been teaching since I was 17, and I've been dancing since I was 5.
Yeah.
I know Carl has taught his whole life, but not necessarily dance. He got into dance later in life, so. Ooh.
Yes.
So you were teaching before you got into dance then?
I spent my whole life in the martial training world.
Really?
So I ran martial training facilities. I opened my first one when I was 20 years old. Before that, I helped run a school for the coach of the U.S. national team and the Illinois state team. So I did that as a youth. And then when I was 20 years old, I lied on paperwork and I opened up my first school on the south side of Chicago. And so I did that my whole life. I've been teaching dance now for about 25 years, so I got into dance at a later date, but I was teaching, I've been helping teach classes probably since I was 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 61 now. It's a long time. So I've been teaching for a long time.
Yeah, and then how long has Vargo been around?
We just celebrated our 13th year.
Do you feel like has the business and what you guys do and like your approach to it, has it changed or evolved?
Since COVID or in general?
In general, and obviously I'm sure COVID too.
I think in the beginning I was, so there's a lot of different categories of what we call ballroom dance studios.
Yeah.
Some that just focus on ballroom dancing. So they're like competition focused and performance focused, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. So that's how I was in the beginning. My business model was very Fred Astaire, Arthur Murray type, very franchise type. And then I started realizing about 6 years in that that's not really what the majority of people want. They just want to have fun and dance. And I thought alcohol was a part of that. And
right. Most of the people I imagine that come in here don't really have much experience.
No, none. Yeah. Usually none.
Yeah,
so they're not looking to be the next Fred Astaire. They just want to go out and dance and have a good time when they hear live music or go on a cruise or go to get invited to a wedding or something like that or get married. But they're not looking to put on a $7,000 dress and perform in front of, you know, 20, 30 people. So
we're real lucky here. We get a variety.
We do get a variety.
We get a big variety. We get everything from people that want to be competitive dancers to people that just want to have a good time. Like you said earlier, people, I've had to really open my eyes over the last handful of years at just how realistic it is that people start dance for a lot of different reasons. And a lot of times it's not about the dance too. So
right.
That ends up being something that they end up more involved in as they go on.
Mm-hmm.
But no, everybody wants something a little different. And so how flexible can you be within the boundaries of still teaching them to dance? And that's a dance, learning how to juggle that a little bit.
For sure.
That's an interesting thing within itself. Just respecting everybody's reasons for what they're doing, why they're doing it, and keeping that balance that you're talking about.
And when you know the reasons for why they're wanting to do it, it makes it a lot easier to work with them.
Yes.
You know, whether it's looking for community because they, you know, recently lost somebody in their life, or whether they want the physical aspect of it because it's more fun, they think, than going to the gym, or they might even be looking for love and this is their way they want to try and find it, or they really love dance, you know, and they're kind of bringing back a hobby that they haven't done since they were in high school. So knowing why they're here really helps us to work with each individual.
It's something they can do from high school. You can dance until you can't move anymore, and it's for some people they come in and it's a date night out. We get a lot of that too,
Lots
for some
of date
couples
night.
That are married. It's a date night out, and it's something they can do that's a whole heck of a lot healthier than sitting on the couch eating potato chips and watching TV at night.
It's interesting about the motivation part that you were mentioning, because like I'm sure that for some people it's crystal clear, right? Like for some people it is literally, this is
about
a night
dance.
Out.
They want
to. This is about dance. I'm getting married. I want to learn how to do X, Y, and Z. But
right.
like for the people looking for a sense of community or people looking for love, like that might not be something that people explicitly voice when they come, and they might just be like, oh, I'm trying to get back out.
Absolutely
there.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, I don't
Absolutely
think it's ever
not.
Explicitly voiced.
That would be really interesting if someone did come in here and they're like, I'm looking for love.
We want love.
Yeah. and not only that, but it's amazing how it starts as one thing and turns into others too.
Yeah.
So that happens a lot also.
Yeah, that's a good point.
They start out looking for one thing and they start getting involved in the dance and they find out that it's a skill that they want to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And I think that there's some people that fall into a thing with hobbies. And I think that everyone's guilty of this to some degree or another, where you get into the thing and you're like, I want to just like have fun and I want to dance, and you don't have a complete objective in mind. And people
right.
think that they're like, okay, well, I start dancing. That means that like, eventually I should be like a competitive dancer. Like people get into like this real growth mindset of it. And I'm like, you actually don't. You can actually just do this to enjoy this.
Right.
Instead
right.
of having like these concrete like steps up that
Absolutely.
You want to reach.
For sure, for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then you have the people who get discouraged because they're not moving along fast enough.
There are people who come in and they get frustrated. They're like, I never thought it would be this difficult. And then
right.
there are other people that come in and they go, you know what? I only intend to do this for a month or two, and 3 years later, we're going, whatever happened in a month or two?
Yeah.
So that happens a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
That happens
That's
a lot,
That's kind of what
too,
I like so about dance is because you never feel like you've mastered it. Like, you're always learning.
Right.
Like, I'm still learning. We still take classes. We train.
You still take I saw on the website that you still do some competitive dance, right?
Or yeah, so I'm not competing. Post-COVID, I haven't competed.
Okay. Yeah.
I think the competition scene's kind of changed a little bit. It's
sure,
actually
sure.
just coming back now.
Uh-huh.
We haven't really gotten back into the competitive scene. Some of my other instructors are still, you know, showcasing and performing and competing.
Right.
So, but I kind of just fell in love with the social aspect of everything, and I'm loving the studio life right now. So.
But you were saying you still take classes and things like
we
that?
We still train,
anytime
for sure.
Anytime we get a chance, like it's always good to jump in a class somewhere.
Yeah.
Anytime. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, we spend enough time teaching to where it gets a little frustrating. There's a lot of times that we would like to play too.
I know. That's exactly what I was planning to ask you about.
Yeah.
Like obviously you're doing a lot of dancing when you're teaching and when you're doing the thing, but like, it's funny how sometimes how you get into this because you love dancing, but it actually ultimately means that you probably dance a little bit less than you would like to do,
so
which
true.
Is a
yeah.
weird paradox that you're
I think
in.
It's so probably true. That way with every profession.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
So you start doing it, you love it, you get to a point to where people are wanting what you're doing, and then you've lost it for yourself a little bit because you don't get the chance. But we love taking classes any chance we get. Sometimes Jamie will teach a class and I'll jump in if I can. If I can be here and I can make it happen, I'll jump into class.
And I'm lucky enough to travel back and forth to Mexico during the summer, so I'm able to take classes down there and train a little bit with some really cool instructors.
Train a little bit there, teach a little bit there.
Yeah, train a little bit, teach a little bit. And then we bring out some really, really great instructors we brought out some from LA before, Houston, and then we host workshops here, so we get to participate in the workshops we host here.
Right.
By bringing out some coaches.
That's fun. I love to hear that from teachers, that like you're always trying to evolve and you're always trying to keep things a little bit fresh for both the company and also for yourselves too.
Absolutely.
The dance evolves, we got to go with it too.
Right.
And when we can, Carl and I like to sneak out and find a really good like live jazz trio and get some dancing in. They're really hard to find right now, but
when we do, they're kind of secret and
they're kind of secret.
Yeah.
And we get to get some good dancing in, so.
Keep that on the lowdown. People don't have to know, so we want to keep those secret for you.
Like our secret places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're harder. They're farther and fewer in between now.
Right, because you're right. We don't really get to dance a lot, so we teach more than we dance.
Right, and I imagine that, like, it's a different kind of satisfaction then, right? Like,
so
teaching
true.
Dance is a very different kind of satisfaction than competitive
dancing
or just dancing without
right.
that.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah, it's so different, but
yeah,
we enjoy it.
We've been lucky. We get to meet some amazing musicians.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've met some amazing musicians, some of Chicago's best. And so when we get to, if we get to get together and sneak away and go dance a little bit ourselves, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Do you get to have any live music either in the studio or at events that you guys do then? Or?
We do time to time.
Yeah?
We do time to time. We would like more. You've got to draw a big crowd. The dance scene in Chicago is somewhat segregated, so it makes it a little bit more difficult. Mm. If everybody was in support of the same direction, probably, it'd be a little bit easier. In the end, you need funds and numbers to make things like that happen.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I know that you guys do events outside in the community too. I think that one of the first ones that comes up when you Google your rise place is the Thriller on 38 yeah. One that you guys do. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I had not heard of it until I Googled it and looked around.
Right.
I was like, this looks really sick. This looks cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. No, we started it when I was younger. That was always my dream to have a Michael Jackson performance of Thriller. And I started it as like a small sidewalk performance right outside the studio. And we had like, I don't know, 20 dancers or so, maybe 15. And I posted on Facebook that we're going to be doing a Thriller thing outside. And then all of a sudden we looked outside and people kept coming in. They're like, Jamie, there's people outside like waiting for the performance. And I'm like, what? And so we performed it and it became a thing. And then the next year I got the city involved and then we shut down this big second street right here.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's a big Thriller performance where we host a workshop. We have auditions where we have judges come in that audition all of them. And then we have a big performance. We bring out food trucks. And it's kind of like a Halloween Michael Jackson themed festival. We've got a DJ, Carl DJs. He's amazing. And we had 105 dancers this year take the workshop. And we chose a team of 30. And so it was the largest amount we've ever had. And we had about 2,800 people show up, which was good and bad because yeah. We weren't prepared for that.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people complained that they couldn't see it. It is a free community event. We don't charge for
right.
it. Like, it's just something I've always wanted to do for the community. But that's kind of our, what we're dealing with right now is just how to make it visible to everybody.
We expected it to get bigger and grow, which it has.
Like,
expecting something to get bigger and grow and then talking between 2,000 and 3,000 people is a whole nother.
It yeah. was insane.
That's like, that was crazy.
Full like costumes, makeup.
Full zombie attire, makeup,
we
prosthetics.
We have makeup artists that come in and do all the work.
Yeah.
We have makeup artists. We have, there's a lot that goes into.
Full red yeah. leather jackets.
No, we have no Michael Jackson.
No Michael Jackson.
I don't think anybody deserves that.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that's
it's a mantle. Hard position
the red
to follow.
It's a mantle. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It really is. So, no, we're just all zombies. And we perform it right on the street, so it looks very raw, kind of like the music video.
That is sick. Did you guys record it?
It's all over, yeah, our social media page right now.
Oh.
So, we've got really cool drone footage. And
see, that's. That's the beautiful thing about audio. I'm
going
to try to find that.
I'm going to
try to
no?
I'm going to try to integrate that audio while we're talking right now. People will hear it. That'll be super
awesome.
Cool.
Oh, that's super cool. I love that. Yeah.
Did you get to see the drone footage yet or no?
I've seen some of the drone footage,
yeah.
But I don't know if I've saw it for that specific event. I think I just saw one of them that's on your Facebook page that's just
okay.
drone footage of the building. I don't think it was with that event.
Oh, when, I know what you're talking about.
When you see the drone footage that's focused
year?
On the piece from this year,
yeah.
And you see it drawing out from the crowd, and you see more crowd and more crowd and more crowd all the way down the block, it's insane. I was DJing the event. I was on a stage, and I did not get that feel of it. When I saw the drone footage, I was like, holy crap. It was nuts. It was nuts.
So we're trying to figure out ways to do it next year.
Yeah.
Given our limited to zero funds
yeah.
to still have people be able to see it. So that's the challenge. But we're working on it.
Next up, sometimes you have a conversation that just stops you dead in your tracks. And that's how I felt having the honor to talk with NIU Distinguished Teaching Professor Gulsat Aygin. Now, Dr. Aygin is a renowned linguistics teacher, author, and translator, and she's had an unbelievable life, from growing up in Turkey, spending time as a political prisoner in the 1980s, coming to the U.S. to study, and then teach at Harvard, and now at Northern Illinois University. And we had a wonderful conversation about her life and
the ultimate goal of education. And we start off talking about teaching English as a non-native speaker.
I did have students rioting in my classroom the first time I was teaching linguistics class and complaining to my chair, saying that their parents are not paying $100,000 to learn about language and English from a non-native speaker.
So they were rioting because you were a non-native speaker?
Exactly. So my chair called me to his office. I was so amazed and so scared. I should say I had just gotten my degree. And I said, what am I going to do now? He said, no, this is your course. We have certified you as an expert, so you're going to go back to that classroom and teach. But he said, I have reminded them of something in the original charter of Harvard, where families, parents can come and evaluate the quality of education in the classroom, which was included in the charter in the 1600s, of course, because it was a small school with 20 students and two teachers. But so he said, I invited them, and just remember that some of their parents will be Harvard graduated and they'll do their homework. So I had that experience. They did come. It was a very interesting experience, but the very same class nominated me, and I got the award as one of the teaching excellence in teaching awards at Harvard, thanks to that class. So I had that kind of an experience at NIU. I had a group of students in this very class I'm talking about, and actually insult me verbally in the classroom, asking me what the blip I was doing trying to teach them their own language, which I turned into a teaching moment. And I got great reviews from that class as well, including those students, because I present myself as a product of good education. And I say, if I can do this as a non-native speaker, so I try to play the role of a role model, I should say. I try to become a role model for them, to inspire them to do better on the contrary. But it has not been easy. I'm not going to say it was easy. It is easy. But when you know what you're doing, it doesn't hurt you or break your heart much.
Well, and talking about your teaching style, one of the things, again, that the person who nominated you mentioned, and I had seen this written about you as well, is that some of the students that you love teaching the most are the people who don't come in necessarily with a substantial interest in linguistics, or might be towards the back of the class, might be dozing off a little bit, maybe have their hoods over their heads.
Exactly. That is true. That is a fact. First of all, I like being challenged. You know, I could never do this type of teaching, walking into the classroom, doing the same things again and again and again, knowing that I've done my job and leaving. Because first of all, I don't believe in teaching. I believe in learning. And I see myself as a fellow learner. So I share my experience in learning with the students. So I don't like that hierarchy either. And we can talk about it at more length from an educational philosophy point of view as well. And I do like such students because they challenge me. And I challenge them. You know, when I walk into the classroom, now I'm teaching online, but it works the same way. I have found new ways to adopt my style in the online forum. When I walked into the classrooms, I would be jumping up and down, walking, addressing each one of them. And I always start my classes with music, invigorating music, my choice first, and then invite them to share their favorite music with me. I bring myself into the classroom. I share personal information, which wakes everybody up. Because there are certain things that students react to. I used to be a little more radical before I came to NIU, but because I did teach at Reed College, where I was free to do a lot more, like throwing golf balls to the students while talking, because it actually activates the left brain and makes learning more efficient according to some neurological studies. But I was warned against it by my colleagues because of liability issues.
So, yeah, maybe a squishier ball, maybe you could get away with that.
Still, they didn't let me do it.
And, sure.
And so I do challenge them to sleep. I say, do sleep. If your eyelids are down, it is my fault, not yours. and or your choice. Maybe I'm doing all I can. And if you're still not interested, it is your choice, because I do believe in learning when you want to. Learning happens, one, when you have a question in mind, two, when you really want to. This is not the platform we're inviting our students to, because we present education as a means to an end that brings money and livelihood in life. So that's not how I want to operate. That's not how I learned myself. I had a student once saying, I'm not going to come to class anymore from now on. I'm going to take off points. I said, if you tell me, if you justify your choice as an adult, I'm not. And she told me she's making a lot of money working with somebody, you know, starting her own business. And why am I supposed to learn all this? I said, I can answer that question if we can meet sometime when you have the time. If not, this is your choice. Be my guest. But if you don't take the exams, you're going to fail. I mean, that's inevitable.
Yeah.
And then that student became one of my, favorite students, in the sense that they did skip their, you know, own work to come to class. Because here's what I cannot make them want to learn unless I share my emotions and the experiences which brought me joy in learning. So I do make that emotional connection. And secondly, I also make them think about questions, and I invite them to challenge me. I give credit to students who challenge me, who challenge the material, who challenge what I argue is correct, who give an incorrect, has the courage to give an incorrect answer so that I can explain it for the benefit of the rest of the class. So I give extra credit for being a community member, contributing to a learning community, because a classroom is a learning community where I see the more experienced one.
Yeah, this is what we're talking about too, about breaking down the hierarchies within the classroom, is that they are bringing you things as well as you're bringing them things.
Exactly. But I mean, this all boils down to actually our nature as human beings. If you'll let me, I'm going to get into the more abstract side of it and tie it to my actual practices in the classroom environment. The human nature, I believe, I'm a Chomskyan linguist, and I'm proud to call him my mentor, professor, and friend. And I am convinced about his approach to what human nature is and how learning happens. And he's not the only guide for me, because I've read extensively on the topic, and my life's experiences have taught me a lot. And I was very lucky to be born in a family where my teaching started with my learning around age 3 or 4, when I learned how to read and write, because I was asked what I learned for the purposes of learning. But you know, my father asked me when he came home, okay, what did you learn today? Maybe there's something I would like to learn too. So I thought I was teaching him at the age of 4. And he was learning, because he would be engaged in a conversation with me, asking questions, trying to get details, etc. So I had a very advantageous environment growing up. And my elder brother and sister are very scholarly oriented people too. So I had great role models as well. So I believe, and I agree with Chomsky in that, we are a unique biological organism, right, as human species. And of course, in linguistics, we are aware of it, because language, human language, is unique to our species. But there are more unique qualities to our species than language, which language enables us to do, probably. So we have unique cognitive and intellectual traits. So we are a biological organism, but we are endowed with a unique intellectual capacity to think, to reason, and to communicate. But it turns out all of these activities and creativity rely on our freedom. They're all contingent upon the freedom to do those. Freedom, creativity, and learning are actually part of our natural existence. That is why I don't think we need to do anything exceptional in terms of our learning environments created in the formal education system. If we just let them be their natural selves, be able to express what they're curious about or interested in, and if we invite them to ask questions, then they can learn. So how do I do that? In practice, I challenge them by saying outrageous things or seemingly outrageous. Actually, they're real things that I'm sharing with them. I mean, I, even before it became very popular, like at least a decade or two decades ago, I used to teach a course in language and gender. And I would walk into the classroom and say, who here is a sexist? Nobody would raise their hands, and I would. And I would say, who here is a racist? Nobody, myself. And then I would start asking questions like, you know, I had adult students, would you like your daughter to be non-binary and dating someone of the, you know, seemingly same biological sex, et cetera? And they would be furious. I would say, yeah, here you go. And I would say, okay, at the end of the class, I'm giving you an assignment. Go home to your parents or your dorm to your friends and tell them you have a former death row person teaching me in my class. What do you think about it as my professor? And they were shocked. And I said it at the last moment. And I said, suppose this is the case. Well, how would they react? So they brought in all the reactions and I told them I really was charged by the capital punishment under a coup d'etat in a military, you know, prison in a military court system in my youth because I was a social activist for social justice and freedom. So then suddenly perceptions change. So I do shock my students at times. So talking about learning, I share with them my anecdotes about learning and teaching, what I learned and what I couldn't learn or what I could teach. Under really extreme circumstances. You know, this Chomskyan approach to the fact that we have to provide freedom, first of all, for this innate nature of humanity to surface. So I do share, although, you know, freedom is extremely important, what is freedom was a question in my mind, because what is humanizing for us is to flourish with these traits and qualities, creativeness, in solidarity and collectively. So how do we do that? And of course, in my previous experience as a political prisoner, I mean, how did I end up being more human than I ever was, despite all the torture and dehumanizing circumstances I was in? I always think about this, and that is part of my memoirs in works, in progress, because I understand that, because I always won, so do human nature in everyone oppressing me and trying to hurt me and address their human side in my mind, soul, and behavior, regardless of what they were doing to me. And secondly, collectivism, solidarity with my fellow prisoners. You know, we have a published book, I have a contribution to that, where I state that what I remember solely, mostly from that experience, is the best qualities of humanity. People around me in solidarity, helping me carry out the daily tasks of taking care of my body when I couldn't. And we always supported each other. So that's how we got more humanized. So I share this with my students. So now we are in a much more free environment. We need more freedom, don't get me wrong. The struggle for more freedom against authoritarianism just continues because it's in our nature. We can all do better in any given society globally. So, and I share with them how much I learned teaching and in such circumstances. I was teaching English to my fellow prisoners. They put me in a cell to stop it. I did it, and you know, or in a sort of a ward with cells. I did it by learning the Morse code, and I continued teaching with the Morse code. And when I was doing that, I recognized that teaching with the alphabet is clumsy, because there is no one-to-one correspondence with sounds, right, and letters, because English is not a phonetic language, unfortunately. So I started using sounds instead. And that, later on, I figured out, was phonetics and linguistics. So I had this analytical experience under such circumstances. I was teaching dancing. I'm not a great dancer, again, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't matter. I knew some, you know, waltzes and tangos, etc., when I was there because of my, you know, American education early on in a wonderful high school in Istanbul. So, you know, I do share such things, and I also share my impossible moments in life. The benefits of dreaming for the impossible, whether you arrive there or not. So in terms of the teaching philosophy, that is why, because I come from a social activism, I see parallels in the goals of activism and education. So social activism, of course, is a way to reach the goal of creating a more just, peaceful environment in the society, that kind of a society, and peace particularly, which I'm keen on. Well, the goal of education is a way to enable people who will create that society.
Now, some teachers just exude enthusiasm in a way that, as Marietta Ruggiero would say, infects you with passion. And Marietta is a physics teacher at Auburn High School in Rockford, and our conversation left me infected with her passion for physics and for learning. And we talked about how she teaches her students how to think like a physicist, what that even really means, and dispelling misconceptions about physics that might make students feel like it's not a class for them. And we start off talking about how many students even have access to physics classes if they want to take them.
It's a weird chicken and egg problem because you'll hear some places say that, you know, there's this need for high school physics teachers, there aren't enough high school physics teachers. At the same time, there was some research done by the U.S. Department of Ed's Office for Civil Rights that said something like 2 in 5 high schools don't offer any physics. So you have a lot of schools that aren't offering physics, or if they do, it's one section. And so instead of having like a physics physics, so you have maybe one person who's teaching physics, they're usually teaching other things. And most of the time their training is in something other than physics. So it's the chemistry teacher, it's the math teacher. I remember at one of my early field observations, I was at a small rural town outside of Champaign, and the person who was the physics teacher was also, he was actually a math teacher who taught the physics class, and he was the football coach. So You can imagine how much time you have to dedicate to the teaching of physics.
So you have the same person that's teaching all of these different subjects at so many schools. And so like, they probably don't have the time to like seek out the resources that we're talking about that you guys are able to, you know, collaborate with. And, you know, having a teacher that has access to that and is like really like inspired and like loves physics, have probably, you know, obviously like having a great high school teacher makes such a massive difference in inspiring students to also want to pursue science and pursue physics in college.
Yeah, it's really cool that you mentioned that. There was some data that was recently collected by the American Institute of Physics where they asked physics majors, what got you interested in physics? And by far, the most common, strongest answer were informal environments. So things like the STEAM program through NIU or museum opportunities. So informal science education, followed right behind that by that high school environment. You always say, you know, on the podcast that, you know, The idea behind the podcast is that we've had teachers in our lives who have shaped who we are. And, you know, really when I think about education, is about teachers shaping students, but also it's about students shaping their teachers. And at its pinnacle, it's teachers shaping teachers. Because when I think about those teachers who have made an impact on me professionally, and I didn't see this when I was a student, but I'm able to see it now, those teachers were the ones who were very well embedded in their communities. And I grew up in the Chicago suburbs. And so out there, there's a lot of physics. At my high school, there were 10 different people who taught physics in
that one building. 10 different in the building? Whoa.
So there was a whole team, right? And so even out there, there is a informal organization called Physics Northwest, and they get together once a month, physics teachers from all over the suburbs, and we have pizza and we share demos, and it's this really amazing community. And my high school physics teacher, you know, every time I saw him, he would be like, are you going to Physics Northwest, or are you going to the national meeting, or are you going? And then very quickly, are you going turned into, when are you presenting? And anytime I went, it was, oh, hey, have you met so-and-so? You know, this is my former student, Mariana. And by the way, Mariana, this is this person and this person and this person. I'm making those connections. And so when I moved to Rockford, and all of a sudden I had no connections anymore, not easily, seeking out that community became really important to me. And so when the opportunity through the partnership came to be, that was something I was really eager to join. Also because the partnership provides a way for me to be a leader, but within my scope of teaching. And that also meant that I was eager to pull other people in. So when we joined the program, one of the things that they shared as they're going through the list of here's what we expect of you was, and this is 2019, they're sharing this before the pandemic. They say, well, one of the things we're hoping is that you will go visit some of the other schools of the other people who are in the program. And the other three teachers, one is out in the Naperville area. And then the other two are down in the Champaign area. And I was like, I don't have time to drive that far. So I did cold calls on local schools in the area. And I found out who the physics teacher was at Belvedere and Hananiga and DeKalb High School. And I just sent emails and I was like, hey, there's this program and it's going to pull us together and it's at U of I. So this is really cool and you should join. And so, and everyone I emailed picked up on it, which was really cool. So now
awesome.
We're kind of starting to pull this network together in the Northern Illinois region.
That's great.
And oftentimes, you know, when districts are trying to give meaningful professional development, they're doing this for as many people as, you know, it's supposed to be as effective to as many people as possible. And
sure.
We're such a very small, specific group of people teaching physics. And so we don't always get that meaningful professional development from there. But there's a lot of expertise around the teaching of science, the teaching of our specific student groups that we have. And we've all had different experiences with things that we've been exposed to. So at one of the national meetings, I was exposed to something called the Investigative Science Learning Environment, or IALE, which comes out of Rutgers University. And the research behind the IALE method of teaching, which is really all about getting students to do physics the way that physicists do physics.
Right. I think we kind of mentioned this a little bit ago in the conversation too, is right. Like, I think that a lot of times students going in when they don't have much experience in physics, they go in thinking that, you know, this science class is, we're going to memorize a bunch of science terms. And that's how it's, you know, that's what the class is, instead of teaching students to be scientists and to think like scientists, which at least to me, even saying that out loud, sounds like so much more of an empowering thing.
Yeah. And it's really hard to do. Even if students are getting some kind of exposure to that prior to physics, physics is the first time where students are truly, that there's no way around needing to take the things that you're learning and apply it to something that's even just a slightly different from something you've done before. I often tell students at the beginning of the school year, this is going to be different. This is going to be different from anything you've done before, because in biology, you're a freshman. And so you don't have the chemistry, you don't have the physics knowledge yet to do biology. So you do a lot of memorization in biology. And then you get to chemistry, and now there's math. But if you really think about it, it's pretty much the same math every time. Write down your knowns, convert it to moles, use your formula, convert it back. It's and you add layers to it, but it's still the same math fundamentally every time. And then you get to physics and you have all of these concepts and now lots of math and equations. That's the part that they're always really scared of.
But I was going to say, I know that you say, you like to say that physics is not just math, which is a misconception a little bit sometimes, right?
Yeah. I mean, physics is, I mean, I tell students, physics is not about the math. It's about the models, and modeling and thinking in that way is new, and that's different. It's about using the math as a tool, but in order to know how to use the math as a tool, we have to figure out what we're looking at and how we're going to think about it first. And that's challenging. And that's challenging whether they're taking the most advanced AP physics or they're taking totally conceptual level freshman physics. And just like it takes time to adjust to like a new workout routine and your muscles are sore, it takes 6 to 10 weeks to adjust to thinking like physicists. And once we get over that hump, it's not so bad anymore. But those first few weeks, it's like muscle fatigue on the brain. And that's always really challenging. And now I'm doing these things intentionally. And so progressing through your career, I think, becomes a lot more about being able to hone in on that intentionality. One thing that comes up often, like it's classic, any classic science question, right? Where it's like, here's the situation, and that it's like, which one is going to land first? Explain your reasoning. And I was just thinking about how dumb that is, that we ask students a question that way. I mean, it makes sense why we do it from a like grading standpoint, because it's easier for me to say, oh, you got the right answer, and then read your reasoning. But from a science standpoint, like we don't ever throw an answer out and then explain it. We start thinking about it and then we mark that answer. And so having that conversation with my students of, yeah, it's written this way, but don't answer it that way. Like think through it and then check the box at the end. So it just becomes more and more intentional.
Yeah, that type of question's like backwards from how you would actually do it as a scientist, where like, mm-hmm. instead of just like, I'm gonna write down the answer, and then you have to, it almost takes more work to be like, okay, why did I do this? And then try to, you know, come up and retroactively justify the things that you did, as opposed to like going step by step, find, you know, applying what I know, applying the reasoning, applying the, all this stuff until we finally reach our conclusion, which is how, you know, like actual scientific method stuff works.
Well, it's so often students will commit to a gut answer and then they might even realize halfway through their reasoning that they're wrong, but they've committed to the answer. And so they're not willing to go back. So the classic example is there is this apparatus that we have where you have two metal spheres and you flip a switch and one of the spheres drops straight down and the other one gets pushed off the ledge. So they leave at the same time. One is dropping straight down, one is thrown horizontally. And in my experience as a student and as a student teacher, you set this up on the first day of the projectile unit and you say to students, which is going to hit the ground first? And without fail, students say one of two things. They say that the dropped one will land first because it's going straight down and it's the shortest distance, or they say that the shot one lands first because it's going faster. Inevitably, that's what they say. The truth is that they both hit the ground at the same time. And so this happens and you're like, haha, it's not what you expected. And, you know, and there's this idea, you know, and I mean, it exists in psychology that, you know, you have this experience that's counter to what you thought was going to happen. And so then like, you're going to remember it better, except they don't remember it better. They still stick by whatever they said before when you get to the unit assessment. And like, for myself, being a student, I remember that that kind of environment was not an environment I wanted to engage with. Why? I don't want to offer something and then be wrong. And so when I was getting trained in IELTS, the professor who was running it, her name's Eugenia Adkina, and she goes, when we do that, she goes, that's like expose and shame. when you teach in that way. And it doesn't create that inclusive environment that's going to have students offer up ideas, even crazy ones. And so instead, what we do now is we take the time to make observations about things, construct those models, look at what's happening. I have them work through it and think through it and then make the prediction, and they all get it right. And that's so cool. And that's, I think that's really powerful. And it, the environment is so much more positive, and there's so much more student engagement. There's so much more student voice. It allows for a lot more students to engage, because when I have them doing this, they're working in small groups as opposed to it being, you know, the demo with all 30 students and only hearing one or two voices. And so it really helps that entire environment. I don't need a student to like my class. I know that I've done my job when a student says, oh my gosh, I can't drive my car without thinking about physics anymore. Or I'm always seeing physics through everything and it's driving me crazy. When I hear students say that, and it happens sometime between like December and January, I know that I've done my job. And that's just the coolest thing for me.
And last up, one of the conversations that stuck with me from this year was my chat with Eric Serwin. Eric taught English at Guilford High School in Rockford and spent a few years as our classroom correspondent on our Teacher's Lounge radio show, where we interviewed him every single month to follow the school year in his life. And this spring, Eric made a major life decision. He decided to leave teaching, to leave the classroom. And I got to have an honest conversation with him about why.
It's been a very emotional journey, and it's ongoing.
Yeah.
First was just like coming to grips with that idea, and then like noticing, like, it's kind of a day by day thing. It feels like grieving, right?
Yeah.
I had to go through the mourning process, and yeah, just kind of like waking up and realizing, like, okay, so for the first time in my life, like, summer break isn't even like, I worked for 18 years over the summer, right? I took the last, you know, but I started when I was 12. And so it's just the idea of like summer break doesn't, you know, I'm now just one of the regular folks. I'm a normie now.
You're just a civilian now.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a bit of a hustle. Like, I'm going to have to hustle to make money. And it's just, it's stepping into the life that most of my students have been leading. You know, teachers have kind of a unique way of moving through society, the ebbs and flows of the school year. And everything. And now my ebbs and flows are going to be different. I did not spend, you know, 50, 60 hours rewriting my AP Lit curriculum for the first time in 9 years, 8 years, you know, however long it's been. I did not spend, you know, another 20 to 40 hours looking at what I could do next fall with English 12. You know, I had plans on teaching creative writing next year, which was going to be, you know, a summer project to build that course and bring it together. And like putting those projects down took a couple weeks.
Right, because it's so embedded in just the way that your life works and the way that your mind works, that it's probably been hard to not think and not have ideas for things that you want to do.
Yeah. So I'm finding these other like little ways where like the stress of being a teacher is gone. I don't have a stack of papers to grade right now.
Yeah, there's nothing less like looming in the corner that you have to do.
Right. Yeah. And so like that planning for next year is something that was like the end of the school year was never the end, right? It's always immediately like in May as the school year is ending, I'm already planning for next August or September. And that isn't there. So now that it's done and I'm not actually doing it, I'm noticing like, hey, I have some free space in my head.
You know, I remember over the past couple of years too, that there's been a couple of times where, like, especially at the beginning of the school year, you've been thinking like, man, if it starts off poorly, or if like this doesn't, if things don't go well right away, it might be time to like start filling out some applications. It might be time to start, you know, maybe thinking about pivoting. And so like leaving is something that you have at least considered in the past before. But did you really ever think about getting to this point? You know, even if in the past you have, you know, it's been on your mind of, oh, maybe I might leave, or maybe I could see things going down this direction.
Yeah, I mean, it was always there because the job is so stressful. But the magic of the classroom, you know, is a constant pull. Yeah. And, you know, the desire to have my kids in my class, like it was a unique opportunity.
For sure.
You know, with my daughter, she's a freshman, now a sophomore. I'm not going to have that opportunity with JoJo. And so, like, that's a little heartbreaking. But at the same time, like, I definitely don't think I would have. I never thought I was actually going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly if I was going to leave education, I was going to leave for a different kind of education job.
Right.
But the last 4 or 5 years have been just so much.
Is it safe to say post 2020? And even I remember that school year, that 1920 school year, even before the pandemic started off, where you guys had that huge tech outage. Is that the beginning of it, with just the last 5 years or so?
Absolutely. Because it's like, you know, I remember that year in particular, I was having conversations with colleagues about, you know, our teachers are April tired in December. And just that level of stress was so high, you know, because of the tech outage. And then we ended that year with COVID. And, you know, that was wild, but, you know, it was the whole world's going through it. So we're going to roll with it. And then the next year was all hybrid and COVID and everything. And it was even worse than the previous year. The following year, it was like, okay, well, we're back in school. We're going to do better. Things are going to be great. And in many ways, it was tougher than the years before that. And so, like, each year has just progressively gotten so messy and complicated that the stress levels are just astronomical. Like, for me to do what I want to do in the classroom, for me to actually educate kids that are struggling with apathy and depression and struggling with social media and connectedness and struggling with all of that, for me to do what I need to do in the classroom, it's getting harder and harder by huge measures every year.
Right. That April tired in October or November or whatever, that never restabilized to what it was like before. And there's probably teachers now, I imagine, that like just got in the field that they don't even, this is just baseline for them, you know?
And that, I think, is the key. You know, if there's a hope in education, it's, you know, I think about, like, I graduated high school in 2000.
Yeah.
You know, I think I mentioned to you before, my tech plan was for an overhead projector.
Yeah.
And so, like, so much has changed in the last 25 years that, like, I have in my head a version of education that just isn't possible in today's world. And I don't have the tools and resources to know what I'm supposed to do next.
But, you know, I was thinking about, like, why I wanted to do this and, like, what the purpose of, like, this specific segment is. And I think, like, the thing that I, like, the purpose of the conversations, I think, is, like, was supposed to be to, like, give people an honest look about, like, you know, what the day-to-day grind of this actually looks like and how, you know, behind the music, how the magic gets made, where how much work it takes behind the scenes. And again, you leaving at 6:15 every morning to try to make this happen every day. And I was curious, like, now that you've been able to step out of the grind for a couple weeks here and start to reflect on that, is there anything that you feel like you want to talk about now that maybe you couldn't when you were just had your head down and you were in the day-to-day grind of it all?
I mean, there's a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
I always filtered it because optimism.
Yeah.
You know, like, I always want to focus on the positive, but I don't think people realize, especially, like, just the tediousness, right? I didn't have to, you know, I would be at school 6:30 and contract time wasn't until 8, you know. And not every teacher does that. Not every teacher has the capability of doing that.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to have, you know, a wife and family and situation that allowed it, where, I mean, 50 hours a week in the building was like normal for me.
Yeah. In the building, keyword.
In the building. Right. And that's, and when I was in the building, like, I didn't stop, you know, I'd work during lunch, I'd work through, you know, in 5-minute bathroom breaks. And, like, I never really stopped. And so like as a minimum, so like during the school year, I mean, I was putting in 60 plus hours on a regular basis of work. And that was just normal. That's not including like each at the end of the quarter or final exams. That's not including all the extracurricular chess and everything. So like, I mean, the ungodly amount of hours that I invested in other people.
Yeah.
For 19 years. And I did it happily for a low salary because it's not about the money. It's about doing the job. And then I think at the end of it, it's a thing that I think most teachers would agree with is no one really understands what it takes. You don't have to put that in, right, as a teacher. And I don't want to put in less, right? I don't want to show up every day and just do worksheets and just do PowerPoints. And I don't want to be that teacher. And there's nothing wrong with being that teacher if you can educate kids that way. But I think, you know, like society as a whole, like they really need to appreciate, like, if they want teachers that are doing excellent work, they need to be treated like professionals. You know, they need to be supported like professionals. You know, like I took a student tour to the tech department downtown last year as like a job shadow.
Yeah.
And the tech guys were talking about how great it was to work there because they were sent to stay up to date with their certifications, and they would get, you know, sent on, you know, during the workday to go get training and do all these things. And that's not the kind of support that they had for the professionals in the classroom. They did it for electricians. They did it for their IT people. They did it for their HR people. They did it for the curriculum people. But for the people actually interacting with the kids, it's such a struggle to get the support we need, because the support is going at the students or at the parents or at the community. And there's like not a lot of focus on what it takes to make the classroom time valuable.
What are some ways do you think that teachers should be just better supported in the work that they do on a day-to-day basis?
There's places where it happens.
Yeah.
But like my first year of teaching, I had a principal, Joan Wojciechowicz, absolutely the best boss I've ever had. And on the first day of my first year teaching, she came to me and said, just remember, my job is to give you whatever you need to make sure your job is doing well.
Yeah.
And as we've been doing some spring cleaning, I came across a stack of articles, and I forgot she would do this. She would just slip an article in my mailbox every week because she would know what's going on in my classroom. She would see it, and she would see, you know, from her years of experience, she would know what I would need and just feed me little things to do, little things to try. To help me grow. And like, that's all it takes. Just be aware of what I'm doing in the classroom and help me find ways to improve, because I feel better when I'm doing better. And if I'm doing better, my students are doing better. That's what it means for a teacher to do better, right?
Yeah.
And I think in a lot of school districts and everything, the bureaucracy and everything makes it so that even the best administrators, even if they're trying to do that, they don't necessarily have the time, the resources, the energy to do it, the bandwidth, because things have gotten so obtusely complicated. Absurd is the word that keeps bouncing around in my head, is that the schools where it works the best, everybody's a team and everybody's actually a family, right? And they come together and they know who needs what when, and they have the resources to provide it or know how to point them to it. And I've experienced working in jobs like that before, but not in a while. and it is possible. And that's something, you know, I tried last year. I started like faculty gatherings every Friday. Mm-hmm. I'm not really a very social person, but I went every Friday religiously because I knew that if one person was there every week, more would come. This year I tried to start like a poker group and get some community there. And by the end of the year, half of the guys in that poker group are not going to be returning to Gilbert.
That was Eric Serwin, and those were just a few of the conversations that stuck out to me this year on Teacher's Lounge. Of course, you can go over to WNIJ.org, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and hear extended versions of those conversations along with our entire library of all of our Teacher's Lounge episodes. Again, thank you to everyone who listened or interacted with Teacher's Lounge in any way during this past year, and of course,
here's to all the teachers, the coaches, the professors, the parents, and the students that make education special. As always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests. You can send them our way to teachersLounge@niu.edu. Wherever you're hearing the podcast, you can subscribe, leave us a rating, or share it to get even more perspectives on the show. You can subscribe to our Teachers Lounge newsletter over at WNIJ.org. A big hearty thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of this show. And I've been your host, Peter Medlin, and we will be back with even more Teachers Lounge in 2025. We'll see you then.